Time to take a look at the world of insects today. An insect update from B.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. We'll talk about praying mantids on the show today. We can look at assassin bugs and the insects invading your home this time of the year. So as we talk with PJ, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about insects that are active in the fall? Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. B.J. Leash, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. It's great to be here.
This year, you've seen and received a lot of reports of praying mantids in Wisconsin. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think there's a pretty obvious reason in my mind, and I think it really goes back to the weather pattern we had last winter. We had those very mild El Nino conditions. We didn't really get a super hard polar vortex compared to other winters. And when I think of praying mantids, we really only have about two species that we see. Neither of them are native here to North America, for that matter. But they seem to be much more common to the south and to the east of Wisconsin. So even if you go a little bit south, Indiana, Kentucky, Virginia, places like that, where we have milder winters, they seem to do better. But what I tend to see is if we have a mild winter the following year, I tend to see an increase in reports. And this has just been the best year I can ever recall. Photos coming in left and right. And what's been really interesting, I have not had this before, but just the sheer number of reports of folks not only finding praying mantids, but saying, I have 3, 4, 5, 6 of them in my yard. That really stood out to me this year. So they had been having a really good time. But usually what happens is once we get to that first hard frost in the state, which most of us had last night, that's probably going to put an end to the mantis activity for the year.
You know, they are very good at camouflage. And so that's, I think that's one reason they go unnoticed.
Yes. Yes. They are masters of camouflage. I mean, it makes sense when you think about their biology and their behavior. I mean, they are generalist predators, so they will kind of feed on whatever they can catch, usually things that are smaller than them, but they are very adept predators. But they rely on blending in, kind of having this cryptic camouflage coloration, and they move very slowly, so they're not very noticeable. And then they ambush prey when they get close enough. And they're very, very efficient at that. If you look at them anatomically, and if you think about, you know, the human body, if I were a praying mantis, I would basically have spines coming out of my bicep and my forearm. So when I give something a hug, you know, that's a lethal hug for prey. So that's what mantids are doing. We call those raptorial forelegs, raptoral, you know, makes you think of raptors, birds of prey.
Sure.
So really good at what they do.
What's the life cycle of a praying mantis?
Yeah, it's going to vary a bit depending on the species of mantis. And worldwide, there's about 2,500 species. Here in Wisconsin, we really only see two. And so that really kind of simplifies when I think about mantids in the state. So in general, they overwinter as an egg case called an ootheca. And these can be on very exposed locations. It could be a twig or part of a plant, or I've even seen pictures of them on gardening stakes. And again, that's why when we get a polar vortex or really cold temperatures, it really does a number on those exposed egg masses. But regardless, they overwinter as eggs, and then sometime in late spring, early summer, depending on how temperatures are, the juveniles, which we call nymphs, emerge. And those egg cases might have 100 or more of those, and they start scattering because they're cannibalistic. So they kind of scatter, and they're having to catch live insects to feed on. Throughout the course of the growing season, they are getting bigger. They're molting a number of times. They are growing and developing. And then they reach maturity sometime in late summer. And so that's why most of my reports on an annual basis of mantids, it's late summer, usually starting maybe early August or so, but then really picking up late August in September into early October. Again, it depends on when the frosts come, but once that frost comes, that's basically an end to them.
And they eat other insects, including other mantids. Are they, I'm wondering just how beneficial are they?
Yeah, that's a great question, Larry. And there have been some studies that have generally looked at it, and there's no clear-cut answer. And keep in mind, the two praying mantid species we see, there's the Chinese mantis and the European mantid. Now, neither of them are native here, and so folks sometimes wonder, because they're non-native, are they problematic in the ecosystem? And we really don't have a clear answer on that. And in my mind, they're generally so uncommon here. We've seen more this year, but still not super abundant, that they're probably just out there feeding on some things, but probably not, really throwing a monkey wrench into the machine, so to speak. So in my mind, they're more of a cool curiosity, and really, it's a cool thing if you see one of these to kind of serve as almost an ambassador to the insect world for insects and adults alike, because they're just fascinating to watch.
Well, we have questions about other insects, including Tom in Fitchburg. So let's go there. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have property up in Washara County, and I recently lost a white pine tree that just died. And I peeled off some of the bark and discovered pine bark, a pine bark beetle, just one beetle. And I'm wondering if that was the cause of the tree's death and if they can spread to other pine trees. I have a lot of pine trees nearby.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, and I will say, Tom, this is something that I've seen a lot of cases along these lines the last couple of years. It's hard to tell for sure just from the description, but my general take on the situation is I would view the bark beetle probably as more of a symptom. And what I mean by that is when we think of the bigger picture, what's gone on in the state the last few years, we have had some very dry, droughty conditions that can be very stressful on trees that are not receiving supplemental irrigation. In Washara County, it got sandier soil. And so those trees are probably stressed. Once you have trees that are stressed and weakened or dying, then there are bark beetles that will readily get in, but those same insects tend to leave kind of happy and healthy trees alone. So again, even though you found those there, it's not surprising. I suspect there was probably something else going on, weather-related, or if the tree had been taken out by a disease or something like that. The tree was stressed, maybe dying, and because of that, the bark beetles show up. Now, if you were to, say, collect the bark beetles and send them in and I can identify them under the microscope, then that gives us a little bit more information. But in most cases, those bark beetles are more of a secondary issue that pops up somewhere down the line.
Tom, thanks a lot for calling. Janie in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, will go to you. Hi, Janie. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions, actually. You may have answered the first one. I had heard through social media that there's only one native in this area of the praying mantis, and that most of what we would be likely to see would be non-natives. And I wondered what percentage of what we might be likely to see would be natives, and also if there is a source for natives to be obtained and fostered to increase in this area.
Okay.
Sure. So when it comes to our mantids in Wisconsin, I have technically seen one sighting of a native North American species called the Carolina mantis. But in general, that species does much better in warmer, almost subtropical climates. So was that one a hitchhiker that made it up here, where the wind's just right and blew it up here. Other than that, that's the only report of those or that particular species I've ever seen. So for the most part, if you are finding a praying mantis in Wisconsin, it is almost certainly not a native one. That just tends to be how things are with these. And I would say for the two species we do see in Wisconsin, the Chinese mantis and the European mantis, I would say about 80, 90% of the reports I see are the Chinese mantis. In terms of a source to get the native ones, I'm not aware of any source for the native mantids. Also with mantids, if you are, say, interested in purchasing some of these as maybe an egg case, they are extremely labor intensive, because if you have an egg case and out pop 100 plus little juvenile mantids, you need to feed every single one of those live prey. And so I know folks that do this, and it can almost be a full-time job because you're having to move them to separate containers, feed them live wingless fruit flies when they're small, and increase the prey size as you go. And so it's generally not an easy thing to do. I do also get questions sometimes. Folks wonder, can I buy praying mantids to put in my garden to help control pests? And if you were to purchase an egg mass, again, the ones that are commercially available tend to be the non-native ones. But if you get 100 or 150 out of an egg mass, you're going to have cannibalism. Out of all that, you might get one or two adults, and some of those may scatter and leave your yard. So in my mind, they're not really a great way to go about biological control. It's more of a curiosity side of things.
Janie, there you go. Thank you for calling. Let's go to William in Chautauqua next. Hi, William.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Very fortuitous. I just happen to be going by my radio. Don't usually have it on. I am in a hill of beans right now. I've got a nice house here. It started about 20 years ago as a mobile home, but the fellow that I bought it from added on, so it looks more like a house than anything, and it's multi-level. And I'm a bachelor. I'm mentally challenged a bit, and I have a clean house, and it's a nice house. And overnight, this is about 5 weeks ago now that it started, just overnight, about four different kinds of bugs come out at night, and they have something to do with the flies that come out at night. These the flies that hover around you, they're silent. They look like a house fly, a little bit smaller. And but they come out of the carpet. They come out from under the rugs, and it's incredible. I've got many specimens, if you will. You know, I've kept them, and I don't know what to do about it. I've tried every kind of pesticide. Any suggestions?
Yeah.
Well, sorry to hear about the you know, insects in your home, William. What I would really recommend in a case like this, and I'm really glad to hear that you have some specimens, I would recommend reaching out to me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, because what you would be welcome to do would be to send that sample into my lab. I can then examine them under the microscope, figure out exactly what you have and are dealing with. And in my mind, once you know what the pests are, then we can much more readily figure out where they may be coming from. Sometimes indoors, if you have the sudden appearance of insects this time of the year, it could be what we'd call our fall invaders, like box elder bugs and cluster flies that sneak in. That's a possibility. Sometimes we might have like a dead mouse somewhere and you don't notice it. It kind of flies under the radar. And then one day, boom, all of a sudden you have 50 or 100 blowflies that show up indoors. And so each insect has a different story to tell. And until we know exactly what you have, it's hard to really fine tune any sort of management recommendation. So again, I recommend reaching out to me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, send in a sample, and then I can let you know exactly what you got, and we can figure out maybe some next steps in terms of what you can do.
There you go, William. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Just go online and find the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and you'll get all the directions for how to send the samples in. Joe in Two Harbors, Minnesota, up next. Hi, Joe.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. and you just mentioned cluster flies. Every year I spray my cabin very conscientiously with Dethrin product, and I have not had any problem with cluster flies since I've been doing that. And again this year in late August, I again sprayed all around any openings or anything I thought they would get in. About a week ago, I came back to my cabin. Barely, they're all over. They're pouring in from around the windows and all on the glass. And it's a horrible infestation. So I have sprayed again with a bifethrin-containing product and am killing them on contact. And now that it's gotten cold, I'm not seeing them.
You're kind of breaking up there. So what would have, Joe, what would have caused, you know, suddenly he's got all these cluster flies?
Yeah, so in a case like this, if you haven't heard of cluster flies, it looks like a house fly, but the thorax, that middle body region, have these fine golden hairs, and that's a trait that stands out. You can see with the naked eye and say, oh, yeah, that's a cluster fly, or those are cluster flies in your house. The story with these is they sneak indoors or into sheltered locations. They're trying to overwinter. Now, compared to our Asian lady beetles and box elder bugs and Western conifer seed bugs that are going to be really active right about now with the weather patterns we're having, cluster flies sneak in much earlier. And so in this case, I really wonder if the treatment had been applied in late August, it might have been a little too late. When I talk to pest control professionals in northern Wisconsin, a lot of cases they're doing some of those treatments more like mid-August. And the point with those treatments is to prevent them from getting in the first place. If they're already in and they snuck under the siding and then you spray, you know, you miss that window of opportunity. And so I wonder this year if you were simply spraying a little bit too late. Once these insects get indoors, they're really not going to do well. From their point of view, they are drying out, they're desiccating. They really do not want to be active this time of the year. They only have so many calories stored in their body to get through winter. They would prefer to be in a cool location, hunker down, and then leave in spring. So when they come into warmer quarters, it's really a wrong turn for them. They're going to desiccate, burn through their energy reserves, and die. And so with that said, spraying indoors is merely hastening their demise. What I often suggest to folks is if they do make it through, you miss that window, do things like take out the hose attachment on the vacuum cleaner and suck them up. Because again, spraying, it's just going to make them die a little bit faster and you're still going to have to clean them up anyways.
Yeah. So the treatment would be on the outside of the structure.
Exactly. Yeah. And what you want to focus on is potential entry points. So that could be around door and window frames. Usually the siding, you know, to the naked eye, it looks snug, but you take a close look and you say, gosh, could an insect sneak in through there? And sure enough, they can't. So around windows, doors, where the foundation meets the siding, and especially for cluster flies, they like to go to the wall and up. So where the soffit area meets the wall, some key areas to spray on the outside of your structure.
PJ Leash, our guest today, he directs the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email or photo. We're already getting a few of those right now, as a matter of fact, to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking insects with PJ Leash. Great to have him back, and certainly great to have you listening in. And again, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Claire in Baraboo, we'll go to you now. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. I want to ask PJ maybe a weird question. Do insects sleep?
Interesting question. Thanks for calling, Claire.
They can. It's really an interesting area of study. And I have a colleague up at UW La Crosse, Dr. Barrett Klein. And this is an area that he has done some research in. We know there's evidence that insects can sleep. Is that going to look exactly the same as how you and I sleep? No, very different. But there are changes that go on with the brain and physiology, so they can sleep. One way that you can often see this fairly readily is actually if you are a gardener, if you grow pumpkins or squash or something from that plant family, there are squash bees. And the male squash bees will sometimes go inside the closed up flowers and they will quite literally take a nap there. I've also seen other situations in my own yard where sometimes solitary bees, especially the males for the night, will take their mouthparts or mandibles, they will clamp onto a plant stem or a twig or something like that, and then they just hang out there and literally sleep.
Pretty cool. Thanks for that question. Appreciate it. Kathleen in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I was originally calling because I heard you talking about keeping praying mantises as pets, and I actually did that this year. I found an egg case last year and brought it home, and then one day my cat was very, very interested in one of the jars sitting on the windowsill, and I looked, and there are all these babies popping out. And I ended up giving a whole bunch of them away as pets to, like, teachers and friends whose kids like bugs and stuff. So that was pretty fun. But I wanted to actually, I do have a question. I also collect acorns, and we get the grubs out of those and use them for bird food. But this year I'm looking around on the oak trees, and they're just covered in the cypnid wasp galls. And I was kind of wondering, I've never seen that many of these galls before in one year. I think I caught in one day, I collected more than I have in, an entire season ever before. So,
oh, what do you think, PJ?
Well, first of all, the raising mantids, I think that can be a really cool activity. I didn't get to do that this year. I did have an egg case I found late last year. I was hoping to get a batch this year. That egg case or uatheca was basically a dud. I didn't get any out of it. But the previous year, I did do that, was waiting. All of a sudden, one day, boom, I've got, 150 of these little ones, gave away a lot of them as quickly as I could, because I mentioned this on the show earlier, it can be very labor intensive. They need live food, but it can just be a really neat educational opportunity for kids and adults and really anyone of any age, because they are fascinating to watch. In terms of the oaks with those gall wasps, this is just a fascinating realm to think about. So if you are listening and you're not familiar with the term gall, a gall is an unusual plant growth in response to a stimulus. There are insects that can cause galls. There are sometimes diseases that can cause galls. But on oaks in particular, there are hundreds of different types of galls that are caused by insects. And most of these are caused by little microscopic wasps from the family Cynipidae. And these are very tiny. They look like a small, maybe a winged ant, or if you saw them flying, you'd just think it's a gnat of some type. They're very small, no interest in humans. They're really not gonna sting you or anything like that. But they go to oak trees, and there's a bunch of different species, and they specialize. Some go to twigs, some go to leaves, some go only to the underside or upper side of leaves. And they all cause galls that look different. Some can be large and neon greenish and look like a ping pong ball. Other ones can be very tiny, and at a certain time of the year, they can break off and quite literally jump around on the ground, jumping galls, that particular type. And so there is a long history of these. They've well been known. Their populations can vary from year to year. But when I chat with folks about galls in particular, I say it's probably much harder to find an oak tree that doesn't have insect galls on it. And most oak trees are probably going to have 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 different insect galls on it. So this can be really common, but the given type of gall you see in a certain year, those numbers may fluctuate from year to year. So it sounds like this is just a year where you're seeing a lot of a particular type of gall, but I'm guessing your oak tree probably has quite a few different ones on it.
Oh, Kathleen, thank you for calling. Mickey in Dodgeville, your turn. Hi, Mickey.
Hi, I grew up in Montana. I had learned about praying mantis in high school science, and I saw two this fall in the parking lot. Hi.
Yep. In the parking lot.
In the parking lot at Gorgon's funeral home here in Dodgeville. But they were out in the, why were they out in the, on the parking lot? There was a lot of brush alongside because there's a culvert that goes down to the pond at the base of the hill. So there's a lot of underbrush there, but it was so exciting to actually see a real praying mantis. And I thought it was really appropriate that it was at a funeral home.
She's also said one was 8 inches long, which seems almost impossible.
Yeah, some of the praying mantids can get to be quite large. The largest one that we see in Wisconsin is the Chinese mantis, and it can get into the range of about 5-ish to maybe close to 6 inches long. Everyone will differ a little bit in terms of how they're gauging length. Usually for insects like that, if the legs are outstretched, entomologists wouldn't count that on the length. You're measuring more of the body length. But still, those Chinese mantids can be quite large. Now, the parking lot connection is interesting. And I really wonder if there might have been some lights in the parking lot. We know mantids can do very well in kind of these open areas compared to if you were deep in the woods, it'd be pretty unlikely to find mantids there. But they really do well around human dwellings and human activities. So urban areas, suburban areas, and so on. We know they can be strongly attracted to lights. And again, these are ambush predators. And so if they can sit at a light and not have to spend much energy because insects are coming to them, that can be a very good strategy for them. So I have gotten a lot of reports this year and in previous years where folks say, oh, I found this one at my front porch light or my back deck light. That can be a very common phenomenon. Sometimes they will go to this time of the year, like sporting events, high school football games and stuff, because those big, powerful lights can draw them in. When I was in college going to UW Parkside in Kenosha County, I had a friend, Tricia, who worked at a Pick and Save grocery store down on Highway 50. And when you go in most grocery stores, you'll see the atrium where the carts are. And on the wall, there's usually, you might not notice it right away, but it's an insect light trap. Uses a UV or black light bulb kind of tucked down in there. And these are presents that if insects make it into the atrium, they hopefully go in the trap and get caught before they make it into the rest of the facility. Well, some praying mantids had figured this out, and they would come into this grocery store and hang out right by that light. And so it was a pretty reliable way to find some of these was in the atrium of grocery store, which sounds like the weirdest spot, but it gets them with some regularity there. So definitely attracted to lights.
Yeah. And it kind of goes along with a photo that Peter sent us of a praying mantis they saw in September. Peter said this guy or relative is always in the same spot, and it's probably just a really good spot for hunting.
Yeah, I suspect so. And in the photo that came in, I see it's on some brick on the side of a house. And I suspect there's probably a light nearby. And they have just figured out that they can go there and not have to spend a lot of energy and get a lot of food in return.
Dan in La Crosse has a question for you. Dan, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have about a 10-acre pre-planting where I've planted quite a few different subspecies of oaks. And, you know, oak wilt is always a concern, but you hear more about, like, the invasive spongy moss and spotted lantern flies. But I've also heard a lot about two-line chestnut borer. And is there anything that I can do on a large scale, like with the 10 acres, to prevent this? I've heard that, you know, with the dry weather, these trees are stressed and it makes them, you know, more prone to it. What are your thoughts? Because it is a native insect, correct?
It is, yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So this two-lined chestnut borer, it's really a native relative of the invasive emerald ash borer. Very close related, except emerald ash borer is not native to North America. Two-lined chestnut borer is native. And because it's native and it evolved alongside oak trees, in my mind, it tends to be relatively well-behaved. And what I mean by that is if you have oak trees that are happy and healthy, so to speak, that insect tends to leave them alone. That insect is much more of a secondary type pest. It's waiting for the trees to be weakened, stressed by whatever it may be. That could be dry, droughty conditions, which we've had certainly in many parts of the state the last couple of years. That could be defoliation again and again by spongy moth or some other insect for that matter. Once those trees are weakened, then they're basically predisposed to two-lined chestnut borer coming in, and that can then be a problem. Unfortunately, for management, in terms of say, treating trees, we don't have any great options for large areas. If you have, say, a residential yard, you have one or two or three high-value oak trees, there's treatments for that. They tend to be pretty expensive, but again, they're not applicable for large areas. They're, depending on the product using, there's limits on the amount you can use per acre per year. And so again, it's really not appropriate for large areas. With the size that you mentioned, 10 acres, when it comes to situations like that, a suggestion might be to reach out to folks with the DNR Forest Health Team, because when we're talking about insect pest management on larger acreage, that's where some of the dynamics shift. And so the DNR might have some additional advice for you. But otherwise, I don't know of any way you can really manage those on a large scale.
No. Short of if they're really stressed by dryness, figuring out a way to water that area to make them healthy.
Right, right. Yeah, if you can figure out what that stress is and alleviate it, that would help. But for large areas, you know, just getting the water there could logistically be very tough. But that's a good point.
Thank you, Dan, for calling. Doug in Lansing, Iowa, we go to you now. Hi, Doug.
Yes, I've been fascinated with praying mantis all my life, and I've raised them for over 50 years, almost every single year. And a couple of comments is, I've raised them in the south and the north, and one of the problems with them is if it's a short summer season, they can only lay maybe one egg case, where in the south they lay more. But the important thing is, I've raised them in northern Maine, and cold temperatures up down to 40 below do not kill the egg cases. The problem is the short summers don't allow them to lay egg cases, many egg cases. Now that we're having longer summers and longer warm falls where the bugs are still available, because they need to eat a lot of bugs to make egg cases. And the other thing is if you're going to put them in a bottle and hatch them, make sure you take the egg case out once a week and soak it a little bit for about a minute in water, and put it back, otherwise they won't hatch.
Hmm. Doug, thanks for calling. Comments, PJ?
Yeah, that's great to hear. You've raised mantids for so long. I mentioned this before, but it can be a really great educational opportunity for folks of all ages. I know some folks that will purchase exotic species, kind of from the pet trade, if you will. And sometimes folks will spend $50 or $100 just on getting one juvenile mantid for some of these species and raise them up. And you see them as adults, and they're about the coolest looking insect you could ever think of.
Doug, thank you for that information. Appreciate it. Dave in Cambria, we go to you. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I had a question about tomato hornworms. About a month ago, I had an issue in my garden with that worm, and by the time I realized what they were doing, I had lost like 25% or more of the plants. But I understand that it becomes, if you let it alone, it becomes some sort of big moth. And I killed the worms so that I could save my tomatoes. But if I had taken those worms off and, I don't know, taken them somewhere? Would that have been a better thing? Obviously, for the worms, it would have been better, but I'm not sure what they, if I would have taken them to a marsh, would they have other things to eat?
Hmm. Thanks, Dave, for calling. PJ, what do you think?
Sure. So on things like tomatoes and related crops, say peppers, maybe even potato to a certain extent, things from that plant family, there are two very common species that can show up. And actually, the one that's more common of the two is the tobacco hornworm. And then there's the tomato hornworm. And they're very, very closely related, look very, very similar. Their life cycles are very similar as well. And they will be feeding on their host plants, but they're really fairly specific. So if you were to take those caterpillars and put them on something else in your yard or your garden, say cabbage or a maple tree, or you take them to marsh and put them on cattails, they just won't have the food that they need. Also, in addition, once you start rearing insects, and this isn't a rule that's set in stone, but in many cases, if developing insects are used to feeding on a certain type of plant, even if you provide them with some alternative food source that might be suitable, like a close related plant species, they might not like it. So in a case like this, you know, if you were trying to really rear them to the adult stage, from their point of view, they would have wanted to stay on those plants. What would happen is once they got big enough and reach maturity as larvae, they go down to the soil and then they burrow in and they pupate down in the soil. And that's how they make it through the winter. And then the adult moth would emerge next year, mate, lay eggs, and then you could get your caterpillars. With that, those types of hornworms, I usually start getting reports about July or so, and they do blend in very, very well. So as you alluded to, hard to detect that activity until you really notice that a big chunk of your plants are missing, entire kind of branches off the tomato plant. So they can be kind of a frustrating thing for gardeners to deal with.
Yeah. Dave, thank you so much for calling. PJ Leash, our guest today. He is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And you can join in with open lines, get you on fairly quickly at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. PJD emailed a photo of an insect that they and their spouse have noticed in their house since late August. D said they thought they may have come through the screens when we had windows open. And she D says, while we see fewer of them now since the windows have been closed for weeks, we still see a few. They've been found in all rooms of both the main and lower levels of the house. D lives in central Wisconsin, near water and lots of trees. And the photo's a little bit, I'm not sure you're going to be able to identify from the photos, but take a crack.
What we see in these photos, Larry, are some rather small brownish beetles. And these things are in the range of maybe about a tenth of an inch long or so. From what I can see, I'm suspicious they may be something called a foreign grain beetle, which has grain in the name. They can be associated with grains. But what I would love to know in this particular scenario from D is the home recently built? And the reason I say this is that, and it's going to sound a little weird, but there are certain insects that can be very strongly associated with new construction or buildings that were just renovated. And if you think about it in more details, it can make sense. So you have a new home or whatever structure it may be is going up. You have framing, the 2x4s and stuff like that. Sometimes those materials have some residual moisture. It gets rained on during construction process. It's a little bit damp. A trivial amount of mold can grow on that, and these foreign grain beetles and some close relatives specifically like to feed on fungal structures, mold spores, and things like that. So the building essentially smells good to them. They fly in to feed on that, then up goes the siding, up goes the drywall. They're trapped in there, and so I have every year cases that usually pop up in about August, September. Folks are moving into their newly built home, and all of a sudden little brown beetles start coming out in every room in the house. And what that tells me is there's a trivial amount of mold. What happens is as that building fully dries out, especially over that first dry winter, that puts an end to it. And so you just have to kind of recognize what's going on. Maybe get out the hose attachment on the vacuum cleaner and suck them up when you do see them. They're harmless to people, and you just have to bide your time and wait, and they would go away on their own. So Dee, in this case, if it is a new home, that's probably what's going on, is it's these foreign grain beetles. They will disappear all on their own. Now, if you go to my website for the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, I have a blog post from several years ago that goes into more details on this phenomenon about the foreign grain beetles and structures. So I'd encourage you to check that out, because I'm guessing that might be the case here.
Karen has a question. Karen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and PJ. I just wondered if... I saw, I don't know if it's a katydid or leafhopper, or I'm just used to calling them both. Is that one in the same?
Is a katydid and the leafhopper, are they the same thing?
They are not. Although, you know, you start throwing out terms like hopper and things can get mixed up. So something like a grasshopper is pretty closely related to katydids, but leafhoppers belong to a completely different group of insects, and they're more related to aphids and stink bugs.
And a lady and a katydid, they don't look quite the same at all, do they?
No, katydids, the ones that we see, are generally pretty large and robust. They would look like large, greenish, grasshopper-like in appearance. They usually are up in tree canopies, and so they blend in pretty well. But some of the species can be an inch and a half long or so in terms of their size. Whereas leafhoppers are generally some pretty small insects. They are under a quarter inch long. Pretty distinctive appearance if you get them under magnification. They've got a series of kind of parallel rows of spines on their legs, but very, very different anatomically. And again, those leafhoppers are going to be much, much smaller than our katydids.
Owen in Cornucopia emailed photos of a grub-like thing that appeared to crawl out of the cavity at the rear end of a mouse that was caught in a trap as after about 24 hours, and wondering what it is.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the photos right now, Larry, and this is a large insect. These are about an inch or so long, and it's basically a specialized type of maggot. And when I say the term maggot, I'm using it in a technical sense here. This is the larva of a type of fly specifically called a bot fly, and it's a member of the genus Cuterebra. There's a bunch of species out there in our area. Some are associated with rabbits. Some are associated with rodents. That could be mice or chipmunks or squirrels or something like that. But this actually isn't all that uncommon. I've had a few other recent reports. These larvae are really parasites that live under the skin of their host animal. So in this case, a mouse. And when the mouse dies in the mouse trap, the fly larva can sense that, realize the mouse is cooling off, and it's got to abandon ship, essentially. And so this big, weird-looking fly larvae or maggot pops out. Again, they're large, about an inch long. They're covered with all these dark little bumps or hooks that actually help them stay in their host. And if this were outdoors, they would probably burrow down into the soil or under some leaf litter and try to pupate at some point. But otherwise, when they show up indoors, it kind of maybe grosses people out a little bit. I think they're pretty cool specimens when you think about that biology that they have going on. But it's basically a specialized parasite of rodents, completely harmless to people, though.
Mike in Waterloo will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mike.
Hi. For my job, I do a lot of driving around, and I've noticed that this time of the year, you see a lot of those woolly caterpillars, the black ones with a little rust-colored stripe in the middle, maybe. They're always crawling across the road. I mean, why did that caterpillar cross the road? Why don't they just stay in the grass? It just kind of, one side of the road is just as good as the other. So what are they doing, and where do they come from?
All right.
Yeah. So very common thing to see this time of the year. So those woolly bear caterpillars, brownish with some black on the body. This is a species of moth that overwinters in that caterpillar stage. And so this one and some others, like some of the members of the tiger moth group, you can see them, especially on warmer fall days. Like I'm guessing this weekend with the warmth, it'd be a good time to spot some of these on hiking trails and things like that. They're basically wandering around at this point, probably looking for some decent spots where they can hunker down for the winter. But that warmth does get them moving. As you kind of mentioned, you know, one side of the road might look just as good as the other side. So that does make you wonder why they're trying to cross the road, which is, you know, not going to be the safest thing to do. But they're probably wandering looking for overwintering spots.
Jim emailed to say he found a YouTube video from 2011 about preventing or treating ash trees, preventatively treating ash trees for EAB that starred you, PJ. Is there an updated video or site that explains the process?
Yeah, so UW does actually have a designated website for emerald ash borer. I helped produce that video along with Dr. Chris Williamson. That was, yeah, about a decade or so ago almost. And that video really just shows the general process of what a homeowner can do to treat a small ash tree in their yard. So no real updates to that. On that website, though, there are a couple of fact sheets that I take a peek at every year and make updates as necessary. And there's a fact sheet for homeowner options for treating your trees to protect them from emerald ash borer. And then there's also a different fact sheet for professionals, so arborists, which have some different tools in the toolbox, so to speak. So every so often, again, I peek at those. I check which products are available. Sometimes names change for products and so on. And I post updated versions of those. Otherwise, our UW Extension Emerald Ash Borer website has just a whole bunch of great information in terms of detection, biology, management, and so on. And it really focuses on the homeowner realm. So if you have one or two or three ash trees in your yard, it'll discuss what you can do. There's also a fact sheet that really gets at some of the core questions of should you even consider treating your tree? Because there's certain pros and cons and trade-offs here and there, but a lot of great information on that website.
Ken in Little Chute wonders why so many spiders seem to show up in late summer to early fall.
Yeah, so just to set the stage briefly, we've got about 500 species of spiders in Wisconsin, and there's one particular group that can be very, very common this time of the year, and that group is our orb weaver spiders, and these are often very large, conspicuous, hard to miss. They make the stereotypical round web on the side of your house or in your garden or a prairie area, things like that, and so it makes them very easy to spot. Many of those species reach maturity, or they, you know, become adults late in summer or right around this time of the year in early fall. And so that's a key reason why you can bump into a lot of those this time of the year.
Makes sense. And he was wondering about how they string the webs and throw that string across. And can you answer that in 15 seconds or so?
Yeah, gosh, you know, they are very elegant and good at what they do. So spiders have specialized structures, spinnerets that can produce the silk. And then it's a little bit of being an acrobat as well to be able to do that between, you know, tree branches or parts of your house.
On that note, PJ, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me today, Larry.
PJ Leash is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and of course we'll have him back to answer more of your insect questions. Sorry we didn't get to everybody. Coming up at noon, we're going to take a look at the making of fine chocolate and a little bit about the history of chocolate. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Chocolate. chocolate.
Johnny and the Raindrops, a song. I like chocolate. That's the song to get us going today on this hour of our program as we visit with Rowan Jacobson, an award-winning journalist who writes about science and nature for publications like the New York Times, Scientific American, and Outside. He is the author of 8 books, and his latest is a dandy. It's titled Wild Chocolate, Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. It's out just this month from Bloomsbury Publishing, and I finished reading it a couple of days ago and really enjoyed it. And as I talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Talk with him, too. What makes some chocolate better than other chocolate, perhaps? Is chocolate like fine wine or a good cigar? Do you have to be an expert to know the difference? Join in the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Rowan Jacobson, welcome. Thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Larry. Great to be here.
Your new book, which is really a dandy, it's about fine chocolate that's come to prominence in the late 1990s, early 2000s. It's about the people who make it possible. And so there's a fine chocolate focus. But also, we get a look at history. We get a look at some adventures by the people who were really responsible for bringing this fine chocolate to the forefront. It reminds me at times of an Indiana Jones kind of saga. I mean, it's filled with just fascinating information about chocolate. And so I can see why you'd be interested. But what set you off on this journey to find the source of wild cacao?
Yeah, well, like you were saying, Larry, it was when the chocolate bars started getting a lot better in like the 1990s, 2000s. And, you know, I'm a longtime food writer. So yeah. I wanted to know, why were they better? Like, what was making them better? And so my initial interest was in following that back to the beginning, you know. But then as you, like, it got complicated. The Indiana Jones stuff started to pop up unexpectedly, you know.
Oh, it makes it really a lot of fun to read. Chocolate, I have never asked a person, do you like chocolate, and have them say, well, no, I hate chocolate. Everybody seems to love chocolate. A lot of it, though, that's consumed today it's mass processed and comes from perhaps what you might call inferior cacao beans.
Yeah, inferior beans, and also grown. You know, the industry, you know, engages in practices that aren't that ethical sometimes, and when how they're sourcing those beans and how they're treating the people who are growing them. So that was one of the big interests to me, is this new chocolate and new ways of producing it solves a lot of those problems and actually can be really beneficial for the people and the environment.
You know, when I grew up, the only way I ever heard it pronounced was cocoa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You actually addressed the pronunciation of cacao and cocoa and chocolate.
Yeah, totally. Because it's everyone's confused by it, and it's just it's more complicated than it needs to be. Like the real short version is like the Maya, the ancient Maya. They pretty much created chocolate, the culture of making it, and they called it like cacao or cacaoa. And so then that became cacao. And then the Spanish sort of called it cacao. But then once the British got involved, you know, they wanted to say it in a way that sounded more comfortable for English. So they changed it to cocoa. So it's now cocoa in, like, you know, the big industry calls it cocoa and cocoa beans. And back in the Americas where it started, they still call it cacao. And then the word chocolate comes from, it was the Maya word that meant cacao water, because they always had it as a drink rather than as a solid thing. So cacao meant cacao water, but then we turned it into chocolate.
Yeah, and that's been going on for 4,000 years, and it was primarily consumed as a drink?
Yeah, and still is in a lot of Latin America. But yeah, the Maya were definitely drinking it and using it for ceremonies 4,000 years ago. And some people in Ecuador were using it more like 5,000 years ago, and we don't know what they were doing with it, but we've found traces in pottery and stuff like that.
And chocolate itself is, you write about this, is very chemically complex. The number of flavor, aroma and flavor compounds is, I don't remember now, over 700, I think I remember.
Yeah, it is. It's hundreds and hundreds, and it's just like a really complex substance. And you know it when you taste it, right? It's got the rich, buttery elements, and it's got bitter elements, and it can taste almost like nutty and toasty. It's just an incredibly complicated food, and the pharmacological compounds are complicated too. It gives you a good little rush,
It does indeed. Well, as we said, the 90s, late 1990s, early 2000s, the European chocolate makers were sourcing cacao beans from all over the world. And maybe you could explain the importance of terroir.
I mean,
it's something we normally think about relating to wine, as you point out in the book, but talk about the importance of terroir.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a word that comes from the wine industry, and usually it's a French word, gets translated as the taste of place. And it's in wine, they talk about terroir to explain why, a Chardonnay grape in one spot in, say, Burgundy will produce a very different tasting wine than a Chardonnay grape in California, right? It's the terroir. It's the way the environment changes the flavor of the thing. Same thing is true in chocolate. And it's partly has to do with the environment, but also partly with the genetics, the strain of cacao that you use. And basically, you mentioned earlier that a lot of the chocolate that we eat, especially if it's, what's in the candy aisle at the grocery store, is produced from beans that aren't very good. Those cocoa beans were chosen because they produce a lot. The trees produce a ton of beans rather than because they have a great flavor. So the ones with great flavor are kind of back in the Americas where cacao originated, and they don't produce nearly as much yield, but they have all those great flavor compounds that we like.
Yeah, and a lot of the sort of mass-produced comes from Africa, does it not?
Yeah, so even though it's native to the Americas, when chocolate became like a big worldwide product in the 1700s and 1800s, they started planting it in Africa because it was cheaper to produce it there. The labor was cheaper, the farms were cheaper. And still today, about 70% of all the world's chocolate comes from Western Africa.
But the good stuff comes from Central and South America.
Yeah, so the stuff that for thousands of years people were using because it tasted so great kind of got left behind when the industry became, a big commodity. And only recently, when people started really caring a lot about the flavor in chocolate, did they get rediscovered. So they're still kind of hanging out in the jungle, these old varieties that taste really unusual and delicious. So that's where the Indiana Jones part comes in, because you have to go find them. And then people are trying to do that now.
Yeah. And there at one point, as you know, there was an idea that there was no more wild chocolate anywhere.
That's how this started for me. Is I found out about this bar that claimed to be made with wild cacao from the Amazon in Bolivia, and people were skeptical. Everyone thought that the wild stuff had disappeared a long time ago. But this one German guy who was sourcing these beans in Bolivia, he was on these online forums saying, no, it's wild. Really, it is. Like, no one believes me. So I got in touch with him and said, like, is it really wild? He said, yeah, come check it out. I have to go get some more. I have to do this expedition. You can come. So I, not thinking about it too hard, said, sure.
Victor Lehman is his name. And he was an interesting guy. I could tell the little background on him. He was a forester or some training in forestry, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. He likes to grow things, trees and other tropical crops. He's German, but he'd lived in the Amazon for a long time doing development work, basically trying to figure out ways that the people there could make a living off the standing forest so they wouldn't cut it down for cattle ranches, which is the big problem the Amazon faces. So he was always looking at what crops could grow in the forest, in the shade of the forest, and actually produce something. And he discovered this wild cacao there that loves to be in the shade of the forest. That's where it naturally grows. And no one had ever thought it tasted good because it hadn't been treated well. It was often rotted in while people were trying to dry it. So he improved the sort of harvesting production of it. And it turned out it was incredibly delicious. So this is that bar that made a big splash in the early 2000s. And I tasted.
Yeah, and I'd like to taste. I haven't had that chance yet. But maybe at this point, it would be worth it to talk about what happens to that bean and what needs to happen and what he discovered. And, you know, he did some trial and error as well.
Years of trial and error, yeah. And this is the nerdy part.
Yeah, like, but it's like, really interesting to me.
As I was working on the book, I was like, I can't believe I'm going to write half a book about fermentation. But that's the gist of it is to make beautiful chocolate, you have to take those beans through a pretty complicated process, this like chemical process. So the beans grow in these pods on these little trees called cacao trees. And you open up the pod, it looks almost like a squash. And inside are the beans covered in this sweet pulp. And so if you just took those beans and dried them and ground them into chocolate, they wouldn't taste very good at all. They would just kind of taste astringent and bitter. So what you have to do is let that pulp that's there ferment on the beans. So it's almost like making wine or something where you put them all in a box or a vat and let all the pulp ferment into alcohol. And then that alcohol turns into acids, acetic acids, which is the natural, that happens with, you know, with wine and vinegar the same way. As that's happening, all those alcohols and acids actually soak into the beans and break apart the cells in the beans and trigger this molecular chain reaction, which produces the chocolate flavors. And we have no idea who figured that out first or how long it took them. It obviously probably happened over hundreds or thousands of years. But that you have to do all that, and then you have to dry the beans, and you have to do all that in a very humid rainforest without letting it rot. So you can't let the fermentation go too far, but you have to let it go far enough. So it's this really controlled process that you have to get right if you want to have the best chocolate.
Yeah, it's an amazing process, and of course you go into it a little more. And you do it in a very entertaining way. You describe this whole process through the eyes of people who are actually doing it and teaching others how to do it, which I found really fascinating. Shanna in Stevens Point has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Shanna.
Hi, it's Shana, actually, but that's okay. My daughter, sometimes she'll eat different kinds of chocolate bars, and some of them, she says, burns the back of her throat, while some of them don't. So I'm just wondering if that's like a quality thing or if it's a certain ingredient that maybe it's an allergy or what could be up with that.
Yeah.
My guess would be that it's the astringency. Like chocolate naturally has this astringency in it. How old is she?
She's 15.
Oh, okay. She's pretty old. Yeah, I think it's just like, yeah, there's this natural, like almost like if you have oversteeped tea or oversteeped coffee, there's this, astringency in chocolate that's natural. If you're getting the more expensive chocolate and the one that has a higher cocoa content to it, then that's probably going to be more pronounced. That'd be my guess.
Yeah, that could well be the case. Shana, thank you very much for calling. A listener emailed to ask, what are the health benefits of dark chocolate versus milk chocolate? Which brand makes the best dark chocolate?
So all chocolate is good for you. It's got a lot of different antioxidants in it. So the same reason that's good to eat nuts and fruits and vegetables, chocolate's like a very concentrated form of that. But dark chocolate, you know, milk chocolate is the same as dark chocolate, except it's diluted with milk, with powdered milk. So you're going to have less chocolate in there and more milk. And often milk chocolate has more sugar as well, not always. So dark chocolate is just going to be more concentrated. And you can, most of the good chocolates now, they list their cacao content right on the label. So you like milk chocolate might be 30% or 40% chocolate, cocoa. And dark chocolate's going to be, you know, 65 to 85% cocoa. So it's just going to have a lot more of the stuff in there.
Yeah. And we've got other callers coming in, but just a reminder, we're visiting today with Rowan Jacobson. He has a dandy new book out. It's titled Wild Chocolate Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Rowan Jacobson about his book titled Wild Chocolate Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. Great to have him with us today. And several questions and emails coming in. David Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So can a person go out and find these wild seeds, bring them home, and grow as many as they want without domesticating them, kind of like an heirloom seed? The heirloom seed stays the same variety and everything. Would that work? And also, when you make the chocolate, is the process the same with all chocolate, or is it different with wild beans?
Hey, really good questions. Let me take that second one first. Yeah, all chocolate is made in kind of the same way. Once you've dried those beans, you just grind them up and add sugar. And, you know, if you've ever been to Mexico, you'll see these little patties of chocolate for sale in the markets that are ground like just by hand or in very basic machines. So they'll be really grainy. But like the really smooth chocolate that we tend to like, it's just, the machines can grind it really, really fine, but it's just chocolate and sugar and, you know, whatever. Sometimes they'll add other ingredients like vanilla, but that's it. Just grind. It's almost like making peanut butter in a sense. And in terms of growing them, yeah, you can take the seeds from a pod and plant them and new trees will pop up and pretty fast because it's the tropics. In just a few years, they'll start to produce their own pods. Of course, you have to be in the tropics. It's not going to work in Wisconsin. cocoa trees, they like it really warm and moist. They can only grow about 20 degrees on either side of the equator.
And Victor Lehman, who we were talking about earlier, just a really such an interesting character anyway, who just got, I don't know, deeply in love with the wild trees that he found, the cacao trees, and he bought, I think, 13,000 acres for $10,000.
Yeah,
his whole savings.
Right, only in Bolivia can you get away with that, you know.
And grew, he was looking for the wild, but he was able to take some wild and grow them up as trees.
Right. These old varieties that have been out there forever, literally, you know, millions of years, probably you can plant them just like the caller was asking and get your own cacao forest.
Nina and Menasha, we'll go to you next. Hi, Nina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Good morning. I'm so excited that you have this guest on because I'm a foodie. My families are foodies. And we've taken trips to Oaxaca, Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I witnessed a wonderful, the mole and the Dia de los Muertos, which is Day of the Dead, November 2nd of every year. I was there for the celebrations, and they have like little booths where the indigenous people would bring baskets of their family recipes, and then they hand them, they purchase by the kilo, these toasted and roasted cacao beans, and then they mix it all together. They pour it all in, and it comes out like a paste. But I just wanted to tell people that if they can get a hold of Mayo Dormo, it's a brand chocolate from Oaxaca, Mexico. It's the best I've ever had, and I've had a lot of chocolate.
Well, what do you think, Rowan?
Oh, yeah. Well, you nailed it. Oaxaca is one of the world's great chocolate hotspots. Part of my book is set there. And yeah, like every family has their own recipe for making these mole sauces, which usually have cacao as one of the ingredients in them. Mm. You can also buy chocolate drinks for sale on the street corners. You know, little old ladies like ladling out their own special recipe for a chocolate drink. And Mayor Domo is this bigger company that has a few spots in Oaxaca City. And they've got these great old machines that must date from the early 1900s that they use to grind the chocolate on premises. And they make all these drinks and hard chocolates. So yeah, Oaxaca is a like super concentrated collection of heirloom cacaos and cacao recipes. And if you go out into the countryside, you can actually find some growing still.
Yeah. Thank you, Nina, for calling. And Amy in Door County, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Gosh, I hate to have to be the one to bring it up. I was hoping somebody else would, especially right next to all those lovely, charming village-type stories, which I'm sure are a totally different scenario, but don't we have to talk about, is it true about there being child slavery involved in the production of chocolate?
Amy, thanks. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, that's really important to talk about. And it's another thing I talk about in the book. And so, yeah, this is a problem that's been argued about for decades. And the gist of it is that, like I mentioned, most of the cacao in the world is being grown in Africa by farmers who are very poor. And it's crazy. They make about 78 cents a day for producing cacao. And, you know, and that's for their whole family, right? So the prices for cacao have always been so low that the farmers have very little money. And so then what they end up doing is their children work for free. And because this part of Africa also has a lot of unrest, civil wars, and countries that are basically falling apart. So there's also a lot of refugees. And some refugees turn up on these cacao farms and you end up working for free in exchange for a place to live. So it's just really, rough conditions. But it all comes down to the incredibly low prices that the industry pays for cocoa. So these farmers can't really make a go of it. And they end up getting their kids to work for free. So for 20 years ago, the U.S. government actually threatened to slap labels on chocolate products, like certifying that they either were or weren't made with child labor. And of course, the industry freaked out and hired Bob Dole and I forget a couple other like very prominent ex-senators to lobby hard to make sure that didn't happen. But in response, as a deal, they agreed to get child labor out of the chocolate trade by 5 years. And that was in 2001. They didn't make it. So in 2005, they said, all right, we're trying. Let's push it to 2010. 2010, they couldn't do it either. They said, how about 2020? 2020, they kind of admitted that they couldn't even trace where most of their cocoa beans were coming from. So they're still working on it. They have made some progress, but still a huge problem. And it goes back to price. Like cocoa is a commodity, like, you know, like oil or soybeans or whatever else. So the prices go up and down, but it's bought by traders who are driving a very, very hard bargain. And there's so many different middlemen from those fields in Africa to the coast, to ships that ship it to Europe and the US, to the people who actually grind the cacao and then sell it to, you know, the big players like Hershey's. So with that many middlemen, that's why so little money makes it back to the farmers. So what has to happen is more money needs to make it to those, into the hands of those farmers, and the industry needs to step up to make sure that no kids are getting pulled in anymore.
And when it comes to the fine chocolates, there are some women who have played an important role in helping, at least in Central America and South America, to get more money to those farmers, at the same time making some money themselves. And the one woman I really wanted you to talk about was Emily Stone. And maybe just give the background. You're giving some of the background because in I think it was Hershey that pulled out of the this area and left farmers high and dry who were trying to do organic chocolate. Well, you tell that story.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the solutions to this whole problem is to cut out all those middlemen and just establish relationships that are more direct, where the chocolate makers are buying the beans directly from the farmers. So a lot more money can go to the farmers. And so there's more of a relationship rather than just like this commodity game. So because that ends up being a lot easier in Latin America for various reasons. So this new wave of chocolate makers who want to make their own chocolate straight from the beans, they've all gone to Latin America to try to establish relationships with the farmers. And so Emily Stone was this woman who in like 2010, I believe, she was an activist. She'd worked with Greenpeace. She was part of a campaign to try to get Hershey's to get child labor out of their supply chain. But then she decided she wanted to be participate more directly. So she went to Belize in 2010 and just started meeting with the cocoa farmers down there and saying to them, you know, like, can I just buy beans directly from you? And you can skip this whole commodity process, because they were still selling. They were selling for a very low price at the time. So she set up these fermentation and drying facilities so that they could improve the quality of their cocoa so they could get a higher price. And then she set up arrangements with chocolate makers in the U.S. so that the beans would be shipped directly to the chocolate makers. And the chocolate makers agreed to pay higher prices, partly because the quality was good and partly because they wanted to help out the farmers. And so then she developed this company called Uncommon Cacao that has become sort of the main middleman for fine chocolate, that finds these really great beans in the Americas and sells them directly to these small, what are called bean to bar chocolate makers in the US. And this has really changed the game. So a lot more money for the farmers, a lot better quality chocolate. So everybody's happier on both ends. And that's a lot of my book focuses on this sort of completely separate system for producing and supplying chocolate.
And she had to do a bit of educating on her own, if I'm not mistaken, of educating farmers on, you know, how to prepare and have those beans properly processed and so forth and dried.
Yeah, and that was the key. Like they kind of knew how to make it good, but one of the things that's hard for us, I think, in the U.S. to wrap our heads around is like how little these farmers have to work with. Like none of them have vehicles usually. It's really, you know, like developing world conditions. So their houses are pretty simple. They get around on foot or by bus. So, you know, say you're a farmer, you've got all these cocoa beans. Even if you manage to, you know, successfully ferment and dry them with your very limited infrastructure, what happens then? In Belize, there used to be one buying station. So all the farmers had to carry, you know, hundreds of kilos of beans that they had just dried onto a bus with them and travel to the buying station and hope the buying station was open because it was only open like once or twice a week, and hope that they were buying that day and would buy the beans. Otherwise, they would have to haul them all back on the bus. So insane system. And like, you can see why it basically wasn't working. So what Emily Stone did at the age of 25 when she arrived was to create this whole new, this centralized facility called Maya Mountain Cacao that would buy, would prompt, guarantee to buy all of the beans from these farmers and in fact would send a truck around to pick them up. So it's just, it's like a simple solution like that makes all the difference to these farmers in some of these very poor places. So the quality was good. The farmers, it was much easier for the farmers. So then more and more people started farming cacao in the area. And Belize has now become like a leader in fine chocolate.
Yeah, it has indeed. And she had her own troubles. You know, we haven't talked at all about coyotes, what they called coyotes, who were kind of mad about the fact that she was buying up these were guys who were going around and just picking up the pods or the beans and giving nothing or very little for that. And here she was coming in and promising higher money, more money.
Yeah, one of the things that really surprised me was how often the chocolate trade intersects with crime, with organized crime in these places that tend to be fairly lawless places, whether it's a drug trade or just like, you know, everyday crime. But yeah, so these farmers who had no way to sell their beans and had no vehicles before someone like Maya Mountain was sending a truck around, their coyotes are these, people in Latin America who do have maybe a vehicle and will just go town to town buying whatever farmers are producing for incredibly low amounts of money because they know they're the only game in town. So they'll be like, oh, you got some corn, you got some cacao, you know, I'll give you a buck for it. And often farmers were just forced to take it. So Emily and Maya Mountain Cacao basically started shouldering those coyotes out of the game by offering much higher prices and more convenience, first in Belize and then in Guatemala. And now a common cacao operates in a number of different countries. But not surprisingly, the coyotes were not thrilled to be losing. So there's been guns, there's been threats, there's been machetes. That's just constantly part of the like sort of like simmering background of chocolate production, you know?
Yeah. Rana in Lake Halley has a question about some combinations of cacao and other things. Let's go there. Hi, Ron. Rana.
Hi, Larry. Hello to your guest. I've read your articles many times in Scientific American, and I'm very excited to listen to your talk today. Two questions is, what would you recommend for a good cacao and dried pepper combination to drink? You know, a dried pepper with capsaicin, not black pepper, that wouldn't light my mouth on fire. And then the second one is, from the Jack Nicholson movie, Cocopelli. Is that actually real? I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you so much.
I don't know that Jack Nicholson movie, so you'll have to fill me in on that one.
I don't either. But what about the other part of the question?
Oh, so, all right. So for chocolate, I would send anyone who wants to like sort of check out some of these really great chocolates. There's a website called Caputo's, and Caputo's is the primary importer of fine chocolate in the U.S. And so they have all the good stuff on their site. And then I believe the chocolate ships for free. That selection, you can't go wrong. Just look for any of the drinking chocolates or the sipping chocolates, because those will come in small bits that are really easy to dissolve in hot water. And some of them do have spice in them. There's a shop in New Hampshire called Dancing Lion Chocolate. This guy he was a nuclear physicist who became a chocolate maker. And he takes his chocolate craft about as seriously as he took nuclear physics. So he does some amazing products, and he sells an incredible drinking chocolate. He's got two of them. One is spicy and one is not spicy. So you could go for either one.
I have the fortune. In Madison, we have some chocolatiers, some very good ones. And I have the advantage of living a five-minute or a little less than five-minute walk from Gail Ambrosius, chocolatier.
Oh, yeah.
Who was named one of the 10 best chocolatiers in North America.
Yeah, no, you're sitting pretty there.
And she always has some chocolate, liquid chocolate that you can just taste when you come in the store or in her shop. And she is one of the people who I think probably has benefited a lot from the work that was done by the gal that we were talking about earlier, whose name's Emily Stone. Mm-hmm. Because she works Gail, for example, works directly with farmers, has been there, actually lived on the farms, has spent time on the farms, and uses single source chocolate for a lot of hers.
Yeah, no, she's well known in the industry, and she's very representative of this new wave of chocolatiers who are really partnering with the farmers in a way that never used to happen in the old days.
Yeah. Talking today with Rowan Jacobson, and we have some more callers online. We have some email questions, but you can join in, try to get on here. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. His book, take a look at it. It's titled Wild Chocolate Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our guest today, Rowan Jacobson, his book titled Wild Chocolate, and let's take a call from Kathy in Harshaw, Wisconsin. Kathy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I tuned in late, so I don't know if you've discussed Fortunato chocolate or seen the book on Finding Fortunato. So the fellow says that they found a rare chocolate that they thought had gone extinct. It was the National white cacao bean. They found it in a remote canyon in Peru. And it was at small farmers. I guess it was a chocolate that was preferred by nobility in Europe when they were first invaded by the Europeans. And they thought it had gone extinct. But they found it in a small farm. And they said the secret of it was it was a mixture of many fruit trees and nut trees, and that the roots kind of intermingle and they absorb some of the qualities of those trees. I didn't know if you'd already discussed this or not.
Well, we certainly have talked a bit about the wild trees and people thinking they were extinct, but what about this particular white bean?
Yeah, Fortunato is another one of the famous ones. It's one of the ones I mentioned in the book, and it's a great story where it was back in the 1700s. It was the pride of Ecuador, and all their chocolate was made with it. And it did have most cacao beans are purple, and that purple the bitterness compounds are in the purple. So since ancient times, people have looked for trees that produced whiter beans because they didn't have that bitterness in them. And back in the day, they didn't have any sugar, so they were drinking it unsweetened. So you really wanted to get that bitterness out if you could. So the white beans were really prized. And then, of course, as I was saying earlier, it became a big industry worldwide. They weren't so worried about flavor. So these beautiful white bean varieties got forgotten and left to the jungle. And everyone thought they were extinct, but they are being found more and more, and Peru and Ecuador are two of the hot spots that probably have more than anywhere else. That Fortunato was literally this, like, it really was like Indiana Jones, where it was this valley that was really hard to get to, and the trees had just been growing there for centuries, and then these guys that were working with a local mining operation found them and thought they were weird looking, and had heard that white beans were were prized and everyone was looking for them. So they brought them to the industry, brought them to some cocoa experts. And the experts were like, oh my God, where did you guys get this? And so now they're back, and you can find those on the Caputo site too.
Yeah. And Matt, you have a piece on Matt, stories relating to Matt Caputo in your book.
Yeah, so he's been an important player who is just really passionate about these about helping the farmers and bringing some of these really unusual tastes back into circulation so people can experience them.
Rick in Sturgeon Bay, what's on your mind?
Oh, hello, Larry, and thank you for taking my call. I worked for many years with the Miskito people in eastern Honduras in an area known as La Mosquitia. Two groups have just recently begun cacao operations, hoping to generate some income for them locally. They're both along the Patuca River, which apparently is a good site for growing cacao. But they're relatively inexperienced, as am I, and so I have two questions. One, where might we be able to contact someone who could give us some expertise about growing, cultivating cacao? And then the second one would be, where could we look for someone here in the States that might be interested in buying the cacao once it starts producing?
Hmm. Yeah, really great questions, and that's amazing. That's fascinating. Those are also good cacao operation, good cacao places. I would recommend reaching out to a group called the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund. This is a nonprofit that focuses on bringing back these old varieties, and they'd be a great first point of contact. You can find their website quite easily. It's hcpcacao.org, I think, and so they can help connect you with people who are interested. And they also, you can actually submit your beans for heirloom designation through them. And so then they work with a lot of chocolate makers to connect chocolate makers and chocolate growers. So that'd be a good place to start.
Yeah, and maybe talk a bit more about that foundation, because that's in and of itself an interesting story that you write about.
Yeah, and it actually started with that that Fortunato, that cacao from Ecuador. That was when people started realizing, like, oh wow, there are amazing flavors of cacao to be found in the American tropics, but they're disappearing, right? Because nobody's been using these for sometimes two or three centuries. The trees will get cut down eventually, or the forests will get cleared. So suddenly, everyone realized time was tight, and somebody had to really be more actively going out there and finding these things. So it's kind of like Indiana Jones, only instead of golden idols, you're trying to find these golden pods of cacao. So Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund was a partnership between the USDA and the Fine Chocolate Industry Association. And so what they do is they actually reach out to farmers who aren't getting recognition for their beans, but might have really unusual beans with unique genetics. And so the farmers submit a few kilos of beans, and then the beans are ground in, made into a chocolate by Guittard Chocolate Company in San Francisco, but blind, nobody participating knows where the sample came from. They just make it into a chocolate with their standard recipe. And then there's a tasting panel that also blind tastes each submission, and the ones that get scored really high get designated as heirlooms. And then they do genetic testing to find out what the background of the beans is. And then they have a whole ceremony, and they announce the new heirloom designees. And usually that generates a lot of interest from chocolate makers and working with those beans.
Yeah. The Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund, for our earlier caller, in case he missed the name of it, a place to go online and take a look, and you'll maybe get some help there. Rex in Madison has a question. Hi, Rex.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I have a question. Every morning I do a shot of instant coffee and a double shot of cacao powder, like what we would call hot cacao. And I'm concerned about how much lead is in the cacao powder that we buy here.
That was a question Stan in Madison had also wondered about, lead and cadmium content of cacao in South America sources.
Yeah, that is definitely a question. Consumer Reports did a test of, like a year ago, I think, or maybe a little more, and found, like across the board, a lot of chocolate samples were high in cadmium and lead. So yeah, how much of a problem is that? And I've looked pretty carefully into it, and I think it's only a problem if you do a lot of chocolate. Like if you're doing, Rex, I think you said you're doing you like a double dose of cocoa powder every morning. So that's probably a significant amount. The cadmium is just naturally found in soils in the tropics. So that's, you know, you're going to get some of that all over the place. Like we already get cadmium every day in our grains and vegetables that we eat. But if you're eating a lot of dark chocolate, you might be doubling the amount you're getting every day. Cadmium isn't associated with any huge health concerns, unless you're like, you know, your farm is next to the battery facility. And, yeah. And, but lead, like at any level, is a concern. And lead gets on, it doesn't get pulled into the trees, but lead is in the air, like air pollution, especially in the developing world around cities and roads. And it just settles on the beans when they're drying. So the best way to avoid lead in chocolate is to get chocolate that's coming from the rainforest, that's coming from a natural natural area. Probably going organic is a good way to go on that too.
Yeah. Rex, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, the book's just out. What kind of response are you getting?
So far, huge. It turns out, you know, surprise, surprise, people are really interested in chocolate.
Well, I can see why, especially if they read your book. You know, I'm thinking of taking a copy of your book over to Gail Ambrosius. And
please do. I know with my compliments.
I know Gail quite well. And I've talked with her many times, and I'm pretty sure that she would be interested in reading your book for sure. And several people are saying, "What are the specific chocolate brands you recommend?"
Again, go to Caputo's, and everything that's on there is you know, pre-approved for awesomeness. In all seriousness, the one there's one that I write about quite a bit in the book that I should recommend. Louisa Abram is the woman who makes the chocolate, and she's in Brazil, and she works only with purely wild cacao, and she makes a different bar from seven different rivers in the Amazon in Brazil. So you get a completely different flavor from each, that's based on the cacao that's found on each river. And so like her story is a big part of the book, and I think many of her bars are available on the Caputo's website.
Well, this has been a lot of fun for me, and we did not even get into you landing in the in the jungle on an airstrip that was actually used by cocaine distributors, and that story. And you really bring to life what it's like for the farmers and what it's like for the people. And I learned so much. I was just so grateful that you wrote this book. Thank you so much, Rowan, for being with us today and for writing your book. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Larry. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it very much. Rowan Jacobson, S-E-N, not S-O-N, like we often see here in Wisconsin, is the author, and his book titled Wild Chocolate, Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. Thanks to him, and thank you for listening. And, of course, always a big thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud. Joel produced this specific show. Technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. Not to mention chocolate muffins, brownies, biscuits, and-